So yesterday we talked about the report put out by the White House Council of Economic Advisors that basically just came out and said, that war on poverty thing, it's mostly over. We won. It's over. We largely succeeded. And hooray, we won. Which is, like I said yesterday, really a departure from the conservative thought of, you know, just, I guess, 10 days ago, where the war on poverty was a giant waste of money that only helped those people. Now they've just declared victory. And I guess now we can go ahead with a clear conscience and destroy all the programs that helped to, I guess, in their view, win the war on poverty, which means, you know, no more food stamps, no more Medicaid, no more Medicare, no more Social Security, no more any of that stuff. You know, it's all on your own, brother. And I guess that's an interesting way to go about it. Now, the reality is, interestingly enough, the people over at the Economic Policy Institute just put out a new study on the new Gilded Age that kind of throws some cold water on the idea that, hooray, we've won. And here to share some thoughts on maybe we haven't won yet is Mark Price. He's the labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center. Mark, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. It's always great to be here. I think in terms of winning, it depends on which side you're on.
That's generally how it works. But what do you think? We've won the war on poverty, Mark, because poor people have refrigerators.
We've absolutely won the war on poverty. There's more money for the 1%, basically.
I'm sorry. That's not where I was going with that.
Well, you know, sorry.
But here's the thing. I mean, you hear these frames all the time. That, you know, well, the war on poverty was a failure. And am I getting this wrong? Because every conservative I've ever talked to thinks that, you know, all of those programs were just throwing money away. And, you know, it was all waste, fraud, and abuse. And it was all graft. And yet now it's a complete 180. They now say it was good. It worked. We won.
Yeah, the game is over. Absolutely. I think, you know, and for the very clear purposes of, as you very well pointed out, that their aim here is simply to make the case that we don't need to spend money on these various programs. We don't need money for food stamps. We don't need money for unemployment insurance. We don't need money to do any of the things that we have been doing to help sort of alleviate the stresses of how the labor market works, so that they can turn around and give that money back to, you know, folks at the top.
And now we can take that money and give it away in more tax breaks. And won't that
exactly.
be great? Won't that yeah. be great?
It will be awesome. It will reduce a lot of poverty among the very wealthiest among us.
They can get that seventh house.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you gotta, people need more houses. You know, John McCain needs a few more houses.
Yeah, well, so let me ask you, I mean, you know, because I think the average everyday person who's been working longer and harder for less, who hasn't seen, you know, no matter what Donald Trump says, the $4,000 isn't in the paycheck. How bad is it?
How bad is it? Well, it's pretty bad. you know, I think we do this work. Basically, it's tracking. It's pretty straightforward work. It's tracking sort of the share of income captured by the top 1% in the United States across every state since 1917. And basically, the income share, sort of the top 1%'s take of the total pot of money that we have in this country has doubled, really, since 1973. So it's a radical increase in their total share of the pie. And to sort of put it in, I think, scarier terms, basically, you know, it's important to remember, and I'm sure you talk to everyone here about this all the time, you know, in this society, money is voice, and increasingly what the data is clearly illustrating is that a greater and greater share of all the income that we have in this society is landing in a tiny fraction of the population. The top 1% really are capturing the bulk of income growth over time, so that as the economy is expanding, you know, as unemployment falls, instead of seeing increases in wages, what we're seeing is rising profits. We're seeing dividends being distributed to shareholders. And so, you know, a lot of income flowing up and not very much trickling down to folks who actually produce most of the value, right? And the folks who are actually generating output, taking care of business, making businesses profitable, they're just not enjoying the fruits of their labor.
Yeah, there was a word for this. Tea Party people were telling me a lot about during the 2010s and 11. Oh, redistribution of wealth. I heard a lot of that.
Sure.
But the way you're laying it out, it seems like we've been robbed, man.
We have totally been robbed. The wealth is being spread around, but it's being spread up. Absolutely. And just to sort of put it in more concrete terms, Rick, I think, you know, you've probably talked to folks here about some recent research that where labor economists have discovered these little clauses in franchisee contracts. So you can imagine the International House of Pancakes, right? It's a world-class institution. You go, you sit down, you have some pancakes and nice breakfast. Well, they have clauses in their contracts that the franchisees sign that basically prohibit hiring workers from other IHOP franchisees, right? And it seems kind of really weird. I mean, I think any normal person would be like, what are they thinking? But what people need to realize is this is important. When the economy expands, it generates, you know, a shortage of workers. So employers naturally respond by bidding up wages. They have trouble attracting people. And here you have a franchisee that basically says, oh, well, if somebody down the road offers a higher wage and you want to go work for them, tough. And what that means in practice is that instead of income, wages growing, they grow more slowly.
Right.
And that's exactly why we have this trend that we observe in this report of basically the top 1% are enjoying much more growth in their incomes than everyone else. And that greater growth is leading to a concentration of income. And that's the really scary stuff because, you know, we're talking about George Soros on the left and the Koch brothers on the right. These are people who have outsized voice in our democracy precisely because they have a lot of money. And they're getting more and more money over time. And that's some scary stuff.
No, it absolutely is. And you're spot on, right. So let me ask you, because we're told that the smart people, you know, they know what to do with the money. So, you know, maybe I know there's somebody who's going, well, you know, it's a good thing. We give them the money and they know what to do with it. They'll invest in new plants and they'll create jobs with it, Mark. So if they have all this money, they're going to create jobs with it.
And or maybe they'll buy, you know, an album by the Wu-Tang Clan, not let anyone listen to it. Right? I mean, you hear a lot of stories about how capital is used, but the reality is if capital was more broadly shared, it would be used just as well or frankly as poorly as it is used now. You hear lots of justifications for the concentration of income and wealth, and I'm sorry, but they're just all bunk. There is no reasonable argument for the rapid rise in income that we have seen among the top 1%. They are not infinitely more productive than managers at General Motors or Ford or U.S. Steel were in the 1940s or 50s. What has simply happened is the rules in the labor market have changed in a way that distribute increasing amounts of income up, right? So the money that is being made building new factories, the money that's made building new products, creating iPhones, increasing amounts of that go up instead of to the folks who are generating a lot of the content and value within the products that are being made.
And also back in 1953, the top marginal tax rate was 92%. So there was kind of a tax disincentive to having that kind of mass accumulation of wealth as well.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things we called our new report sort of the new Gilded Age, you know, sort of referring to the period since 1973 as a return to an America that sort of prevailed in the late 19th century. And, you know, it was an era that Mark Twain basically said, you know, we had a lot of prosperity, but it was pretty thin. It wasn't widely distributed. It was an era of a lot of corruption, the robber barons. And what happened is sort of post the Great Depression, you had rapid increases in the top marginal tax rate. So, and that has the effect of reducing inequality by lowering incomes at the top. You had an expansion of union density. So union membership rose rapidly in the AFL and the CIO separately. They then merged. And you had things like the implementation of the minimum wage, which rose and reached a peak in 1968. Each of those things since 1973 have been unraveled. Right. Union density has been declining. Union membership is down as a share of the economy. The minimum wage has less purchasing power today. And, of course, top tax rates have been cut dramatically. And this is all just looking at through 2015, right? It doesn't take into account that in the past year, we just passed a federal tax package, which is going to deliver 83 cents of every dollar of tax cut to the top 1%. The Supreme Court just ruled in the Janus case, basically limiting the capacity of what the stronger parts of the labor movement, those embedded in the public sector, in order to advocate for the interests of their workers and to defend them. And you know, we are headed in a very wrong direction, and is a direction that is going to only lead to increasing inequality in the years ahead. And it's quite scary. I mean, I think the one upside is these things take a long time to unfold. So I think we have some capacity to turn things around in this country, but it's going to be a long, long, difficult fight.
Yeah, you lay that out, and it you go, how did we allow that to happen? How did we, as a society, as a working class, yeah, how did we allow that to happen? I mean, it's mind blowing to me when you lay it out in you know, that succinct of terms.
Yeah, I think, you know, we get distracted, unfortunately, right? And I think, you know, you can look back to the 1970s and maybe, you know, folks weren't really paying enough attention as they should have, thinking not enough in broad terms. But, you know, I think, you know, there are also a good case to make that we just don't do a good job in this country of teaching each other about the importance of things like collective action, about the minimum wage. I mean, teaching the stories, you know, listening to the intro before my segment started, right? Learning about the International Longshoremen's Union, right? This is one of the most effective institutions in this society. It created a wonderful institution where it didn't matter who the employer was, right? You went to do your work, you got income, you had a good retirement, good health care. It was a great institution, and it was an important step forward, and it's not something that the most people know about or taught about. So I think we failed in a lot of respects. I think we stopped paying attention. I think we stopped voting for the right reasons, right? Stopped focusing on collective action, on the importance of taking care of your brother. You know, there are a whole range of things that I think we got creamed. And of course, you know, we're also now getting creamed because, again, speech, you know, is money these days. And the people with the money are the ones with the most speech. And of course, in a world in which income inequality is rapidly rising and out of control, you know, we have increasingly less speech.
Yeah, I mean, we're right back into the heart of the Gilded Age. I want to go back to something you were talking about a minute ago, with the non-compete clauses and stuff that are, you know, I first heard about it when Jimmy John's tried to force their employees to sign non-compete agreements. If anything with a sandwich, if anything with a piece of bread, you cannot work for them. And you know, right. While it's not legal, I mean, it isn't really enforceable. It's people actually think that it is, so it has that chilling effect, regardless if there's legal you know, strength behind it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And thinking about the other cases of where the franchisee is having to sign these agreements, you know, it has a real impact, not just in workers' behavior, but right in a manager, right, who's got a problem. He needs a staff. He needs a cook. He needs a waitress. And he wants to hire, and the people that come in the door, oh, well, where do you work now? Oh, well, I work at the IHOP down, you know, on 3rd Street. Oh, well, I'm sorry, I can't hire you. And that has, again, real impacts, because the reason people switch jobs is because either they don't like their employer, right? They don't like the manager, they don't like the boss, or the wages are low. And when you cut that of capacity for people to find a higher paying job away, that can add up, and it adds up in dollars and cents. People have less in their paychecks over time.
Yeah. You know, I just had a conversation with my Tea Party dentist the other day, where he seems to believe wages are going through the roof, because he believes, you know, as you've laid out, that as the economy gets tighter, as there are more jobs than there are people, that people that employers will bargain and raise wages to attract people. Is that happening?
It's not happening to the degree that we'd like it. And that's, I think, an important, you know, there's a glimmer of truth, right, in his understanding. When you look at the income data for the over time, one of the things that comes out very clearly, what we all know, there's a business cycle, right? You know, a recession happens, people lose their jobs, businesses shut down, and then slowly a recovery begins. And, you know, firms expand, workers find new employment. One of the things that's happened since 1973 is that when we've entered expansions, that's where all the action is in terms of income growth for most people. And the sad, painful truth is there just hasn't been as much action as we'd like to see. So here we are now in an economy with unemployment rates that are actually incredibly low relative to historical averages. And yet we're seeing very minuscule wage growth. We're seeing some, but it's not adding up to the kind of levels, and it's occurring very late in the business cycle to the extent that people don't make a lot of ground, right? Back in the day when people would lose a job as a result of recession, they might suffer a big wage loss, but because wages were growing so fast, they'd make up most of the ground very quickly within a few years. Today, the story is very different. It takes a lot longer for people to make up ground that they lost, and sometimes folks don't even make up that ground. In fact, frankly, when you look at the income data now in the United States, most workers are still struggling to cover after you adjust for the effect of inflation, or most workers are struggling even to get back to where they were in 2000.
Wow. Last question I've got for you. Now that we know that obviously the war on poverty is not won, and we know that there is a serious problem, how do we address this? How do policymakers address this? How do workers address this? Where do we begin?
Well, I mean, you know, you're talking to a wonk, right? So certainly, you know, I'm going to wonk you, right? I mean, there are simple, straightforward things you can do, right? Support minimum wage increase. Do things to expand access to collective bargaining, make it easier for workers to form unions. You know, change the law to pull out, you know, the people's capacity to set up these agreements where, you know, they basically make labor markets uncompetitive. There are a lot of different policy choices that you could make. We're not doing anything. We're doing exactly the opposite currently. So I think that's the real challenge, is that at this stage, you need a very large, very loud, and collective expression, no, you're going to stop this. And until we have that, we are doomed to have more and more of this. So I think it's more than obviously the next election is very important, but I think people need to basically begin drawing a line, right? And this is a world in which we are making scapegoats out of immigrants. This is a world in which we are basically taking wages out of workers' paychecks. It is a crazy, messed up world. And I think increasingly we need to, as a group, as a society, begin to say no and say it very loudly and make it very clear to people who are in power that you're gone if this keeps happening.
That's exactly it. Vote the bums out. November 6th. I love marches. March to the polls. Mark, I appreciate the time. Good stuff. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Rick. Great to be here, as always.
As always, our good friend Mark Price, labor economist over at the Keystone Research Center. We'll get links out on how you can check out the new Gilded Age piece. Maybe you can find something that you like. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show.